Value Invest Asia, this is The Asian Mavericks. We explore the hidden stories of successful founders, business leaders, and investors in Asia. Here's your host, Stanley Lim.
So this week, I got the opportunity to speak to the CEO of AIMS APAC REIT, Mr. Russell Ng. The REIT is listed on Singapore Stock Exchange, and it focuses in industrial and logistic properties in Singapore and Australia. So I sat down with Russell to understand not just about the REIT, but also about his own personal journey to the top job at AIMS APAC REIT. Russell actually grew up in Australia, but he really struck me as a true global citizen at heart. After he graduated from school, he went to Hong Kong to work before settling down in Singapore. Over his career, he has worked various roles within the real estate industry, from fund management, corporate finance, investor relationship, and now as CEO, overseeing a REIT with more than 2.3 billion Singapore dollars in asset. In this interview, you're going to hear more about his personal journey into the industry, how he went through the global financial crisis, and also his plan for AIMS APAC REIT going forward. So let's start right at the beginning from his childhood.
Look, I grew up in a family of four kids. I was the middle child. So I would say through that process, there's a lot of negotiating, you know, jostling for attention. But generally, it was a pretty happy childhood. Grew up in Malaysia. I immigrated to Sydney, Australia, back in 1987. So a fairly young age, and spent most of my formidable years growing up in Sydney. Went to the local schools there. So it was a pretty good show.
Right. And do you consider yourself a rather competitive kid since young? Or?
Look, I would say very. So grew up in Australia. There's I think the sporting culture is quite large there. Was quite an avid athlete. I was in the 100-meter race, 200 meters long jump. Represented both the primary and the high school at the state and regional level. So fairly competitive on that front. I also enjoy my basketball. So I grew up in the days of Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. And spent many hours in the backyard just shooting hoops with my brother, who was 6 years older than I was. So it was a much more of a competitive sort of belt at a young age. But certainly sports has been a big focus of my younger childhood. But I also try to broaden my activity. So I've taken up everything from skateboarding, you know, breakdancing, surfing. So I've done a wide variety of sports, but certainly that was a very key part of my childhood.
Nice. Okay. And it seems like you're very adventurous and willing to try new things. Walk me through how do you end up choosing the direction that you went in during university? How do you end up choosing the course that you decided on?
Sure. Look, I've always been interested in business. And so I was fortunate. We did have a topic called business studies, which I excelled at in high school. So at the time when I was deciding on the degree, obviously you're not quite sure which direction to go. But I think commerce, accounting and finance provided a safe bet at the time. And so I took on that particular degree. I would say during my time at university, that the courses and the curriculum give you a very good framework of theories. Whether that has applied, I would say it's more about being disciplined and consistent to achieve certain outcomes. So I would say that's been a little key part of that particular journey. But also during my time, I did take on quite a number of part-time jobs. All types of odd jobs, worked as an account receivables clerk. I took on a job part time as an assistant accountant, working with the CFO in my third year of university. Then at the same time, I took on another part time job with one of the Australian banks in the back office. Just wanted to understand the different options that was available, and also wanted to position myself after graduation. So if there was a potential opportunity within the bank. With that firm, I would have hopefully some inside knowledge and potentially building some networks that could potentially help me lead to some opportunity. So
wow, so it seems that you are thinking quite far ahead. ever since your university days. Is that something that, I'm just wondering and assuming, is it something that is instilled in you from your parents, or were they strict in your academic pursuit, or were they pretty laid back and got used to the Aussie lifestyle?
Sure. Look, by I think my father was actually working back in Malaysia, also for the family business for a period of time. So I never really saw him during my high school years. But I do recall, whenever we spoke, he had the same quote, and that is still imprinted in my mind. He said, never be complacent. And that was something he basically instilled at a very early age, don't be too comfortable. So I would say that's certainly been a value that I've taken on board. Always looking to strive for a next goal. And so I would say that's something that was instilled. But during the high school years, I wasn't I was so forward thinking in that sense. I was an above average student. I was fortunate to be in a good school. It was a selective school, an equivalent of schools like the HCS and Wagon today. So in my mind, I was always saying, just be above average, just be in the group, but have a life. So I did all types of activities, sports, and obviously fairly sociable. And managed to be able to connect with all, people from all walks of life as well. When I moved to university, I think my first year, it was a pretty average set of results. It wasn't great. In fact, I failed one subject. And I think my big realization came was I followed my brother to Europe for 2 weeks, just to go to 4 different countries in Europe. And during that time, I had this thought that the world is so big. And if you don't, really focus on what's in front of you. You won't have the opportunity to travel again later on. So I would say that trip was, for me personally, at a turning point. And so once I got back from that trip, I made it a point to have a very fixed, set of schedules to achieve certain goals. And I wanted to deliberately have that turnaround of results. So it was a combination of that, of really sort of refocusing my efforts in terms of achieving the results, but also thinking a little bit ahead in terms of potential job opportunities.
Right. Yeah. And I guess that trip has been quite formative for you. Mm. And after you graduated, did you dive right into the real estate industry? Because from what I saw, you have been in mostly the real estate industry for quite a period of time. Is that something, a deliberate choice of you to dive into this industry, or?
Yes, it was. Look, it was probably something as funny as picking up a magazine in a library one day and showing that there was a lot of successful business people in Australia. And I realized that 9 out of 10 of those people had built their company and their wealth through real estate. So that piqued my interest. That was probably the first point where I was like, oh, okay, that sounds like an interesting area to focus into. And the more I sort of went into the CBD, I saw all these massive towers. I was quite intrigued. Obviously property is very tangible. And so, yes, I did make it a point to try to pursue a career in real estate. When I was in the bank, I also managed to meet the graduate who was, I think that there's 1 or 2 graduates in the property and finance industry for that bank. And so I asked them, what were the secrets? What were they looking for in a potential candidate? So through that process of buying coffee, making sure I bought him lunch and sort of picking his brains, through that part-time role, I managed to get into an interview with the head of departments. And so was fortunate to be offered a graduate role within the bank, within the property and construction finance industry. So that was where it sort of started. I would say over the years, property is very much a people business. You're dealing with stakeholders across the various value chains. From both from a development standpoint, you're dealing with architects, you're dealing with engineers, you're dealing with building surveyors. From an asset management standpoint, you're dealing with valuers, you're dealing with property agents. From a REIT management standpoint, a fund management, you're dealing with capital partners, you're dealing with banks, you're dealing with regulators. So that aspect of the work is very interesting because you're not just looking at a Bloomberg screen, looking at numbers, you're looking at the property, you're looking at the value that can be created from some of the designs and in the work. And so it's very tangible. So certainly an interesting market to be in.
Mm, well, yeah, it definitely sounds that you have, of course, been in almost every part of the real estate value chain, right? Like you said, from being fund management and also to the builders and now to the REIT. But going back to, say, I guess your first job in real estate in Hong Kong, right? How did you end up in that job?
Sure. Look, so before I actually moved to Hong Kong, I was working for commercial bank in Sydney. And so I spent about 3 years, you know, underwriting credit for property owners, developers, and listed REITs in Australia. And so that was great to really get into the understanding of the property industry, you know, key sort of property metrics, cap rates, discount rates, as well as the credit and the balance sheet of some of these players. But I think during one of the actual stints, I was working with a developer doing a co-investment deal. And I sort of thought, it'd be more interesting to move into the buy side rather than the sell side. Because from a sell side perspective, you are supporting a developer or an owner. Whereas from the buy side, you're very much building the real estate and building the business from the ground up. And so I was fortunate. I think there was a real estate conference. The then head of global real estate, who I believe is still the head of global real estate for this investment bank, approached the crowd and said, look, if anyone's looking for a role in Hong Kong, please come and see. So I told my colleagues I was saying hi to a friend, went to speak to that particular banker, and, you know, really within 6 weeks I was in Hong Kong.
Oh. Yeah. What is it about that job that attracted you?
Look, for me it was twofold. It was going into a brand new market. For some, you know, I had an innate desire to want to work in Asia. And so that opportunity to work in Hong Kong as a market was quite exciting. This is just obviously before the GFC. I moved to Hong Kong back in 2005. So that's probably the first one. The second point was really working with a pretty well established logistics warehouse developer and fund manager. The company was called Goodman. Mm. And so having the opportunity to move from the banking side into a pretty established global fund manager in a new market was a very exciting prospect. So it was certainly an area that I had no experience in, but I felt that I could do the job, right?
Well, so once you reached there, what was it as you expected? Were you having a great time in Hong Kong?
Look, as a young guy in your mid-20s, it was certainly a very exciting time. Had no friends and no networks there, so I had to build that from the ground up. But, you know, it was a very fortunate time because the company had only just set up the fund in Hong Kong. And so when I joined them, they almost doubled the AUM, bought, various buildings, doing that 3 years that I was there. And so, look, it was a very steep learning curve because when you work in fund, in fund management, you're dealing with the likes of, your GICs, your RDAs, like all these big sovereign and wealth funds. And so my role in that process was to help the fund manager understand investor requirements and the importance of things, and to really work with the various business teams, the asset management team, the acquisition team, the development team, to understand the various activities and to ensure those activities are sort of properly reported and articulated to our investors. So it was a steep learning curve because it was a brand new subset of the real estate industry, from property finance to fund management. But that really gave me a real strong desire to build a career in that industry. I enjoyed the fact that the fund had grown substantially. I still recall now we made a total return of about 45% in that 2.5 years. So it was an amazing time until GFC came. So that's when the music stops.
Were you still with the company during the global financial crisis?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
So I was still with the company. Mm-hmm. But, the company had its issues. The company is still new today, and it's come back in a phenomenal way. And again, a global leader in that space. But I made a conscious decision at that time to look at something new. And I think there's opportunity to come back to move to Singapore. Singapore felt familiar, given that family was in Malaysia. So it was halfway between Australia and Hong Kong. So I think my original relocation to Singapore was originally meant to be 3 to 5 years, and it's now been almost 14 years. But and that was with and the time was with Mapletree,
right?
Which was a lesser known player at the time, but another group that has grown phenomenally over the years.
And then once you came to Singapore, joining Mapletree, is it similar role to what you were doing back in Hong Kong? Or
no, again, it was slightly different. I joined in the corporate finance team.
Mm-hmm.
And so as part of that work was very much focused on looking at, working with the banks and essentially sort of working through, term sheets for bank financing, as well as looking at, things like fundraisings, hedging strategies. So very much all types of work within the funding side, but also spend a bit of time looking at then tax structuring. So if we're looking at new markets, for example, when we went to Australia at the time, which is a new market for the company, or Japan, or even Middle East, the first port of call is to go to that market, understand the legal jurisdiction, understand the tax framework, and put together a paper prior to the teams looking at pursuing acquisitions in those markets.
Right.
So very much focused on that side of things. But we also had another role, and that was to evaluate the cash flow models of our investor colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think how I did that shift from corporate finance to investments was I used to provide a lot of comments about the cash flows. Now, originally the role should have been just focused on what's the tax rate, what's the funding structure, there's the hedge rate. But I kept asking them, your rental rates look a little bit too high or look a little bit too low? It may have annoyed some of them because it wasn't my role, but I was interested in the real estate side, having worked at Goodman, who were very hardcore real estate developers. And so we look at all the assumptions from market rents to determine whether a project is feasible or not.
Right. During that period of time, you have moved almost 4 countries now, right, up to that point of your life.
Yeah.
You strike me as almost a global citizen, and for your company, you have to work with people all around the world as well, right? So, how were you able to adapt, within different cultures and working with different sets of people? Is it something that you find it quite easy to adapt, or it's a skill set that you have to develop for some time?
Look, I think the first thing is you probably have to have a fairly open mindset. So I think when I traveled to Hong Kong originally and to Singapore, I was always excited. I wasn't fearful of moving to a new country. I was always excited. Now, once you land, you're on your own. You've got to sort of work out your new social networks. But I think that the key thing is once you're in a new place, you have to embrace the culture, right? And that doesn't mean just observing on the sidelines. You've got to participate. You've got to be involved. And so, I made it a point when I went to all these new markets, I would follow my colleagues first and foremost. Where did they go for lunch? Where did they go eat? What did they talk about? And so that's really key, because if you go to a place where you're essentially just observing, I think you lose out on all the opportunities that those markets present. But I would say, certainly in my career, and I would advocate for any young professional, spend some time traveling and I would say living overseas in different markets. Because when you come back to, whether it's Singapore, Hong Kong, Australia, you have a greater appreciation of different cultures, different people, different beliefs. And when you work in business, you're dealing with all types of people. So you have to have that ability to connect with anyone. So I think that's really the key focus, having our open mindset.
Mm. Right. That's certainly good advice. Mm. But of course, well, when you came back, it was still in the midst of the financial crisis.
Yes.
And how was the landscape like at that time? And was it a very high stress environment? Walk us through how do you overcome that period?
Look, I think the global financial crisis, particularly for the real estate market, certainly affected all the players. I would say most of the players were looking at rights issues at the time, fixing their balance sheet, working with their lenders to recapitalize all their source of funding. So that was really the focus, I would say, from 2008 to 2009. sort of coming off 2010. So the focus of it was really just having your house in order, managing your balance sheet. And from an asset management standpoint, it was probably less of an acquisition timing. It was more an asset management organic growth focus. And so for us, it was really just having your house in order and just working through your assets as best you can to maximize the performance. Usually during times of crisis, credit markets are typically closed, or the cost of funding usually much higher to justify making new investments. But I think at the time, the fund I was working for was invested across multiple markets. And what we also saw was property cycles move differently across different markets. Yes, the GFC affected global credit across the board. But in terms of the individual property market, there are different supply-demand dynamics, different drivers of performance. So I think we were fortunate that at the time that REIT had exposure across different markets, so it can pivot its efforts across those markets during that difficult time.
Given your long experience in this industry, your work, like you mentioned just now, in almost every part of the business, which do you feel is the most critical and the most difficult part of the real estate business?
Look, I think there are different areas. I can't say there's one part that is more difficult, because you need every little role to really make the whole thing work. Obviously, from a real estate perspective, capital is important. So you do need to have very strong both equity capital relationships with investors and unit owners. But you also need to have a fairly strong relationship with the banks, because you need them to be there during the good times and then you need to be there during the bad times. So managing that relationship well is key. And a lot of that is really through constant communication and articulation of the strategy and the work performance to date. But you also need the guys from the asset side to really perform, because when you go and meet with investors, you're going to meet with lenders, they're looking at the asset performance and the portfolio as a whole. So you do need the asset managers to really manage the relationships well, so you have longer lease durations, so they start to see rental growth in the portfolio. But aside from that, you're also working with all the various broader stakeholders within the environment, be it the authorities, and also some of your other sort of local communities as well.
Mm-hmm. Walk us through a little bit on, so after a few years, you found your way, I guess, here at Ames APAC. How did that connection started, and how did you end up here?
Sure. So look, I think I joined Ames about three and a half years ago. I joined them as the head of investment, investor relations, and partnerships. So I was fairly excited because I think that the previous role was more of a fund management reporting type role. And so the role really required myself to work with the CEO at the time, as well as the board and the sponsor, to come out at growth strategies for the business, creating new acquisitions and also new partnerships. And so that was really my focus. And during that time, we originated and sourced quite a number of acquisitions, was involved with active negotiations in terms of a couple of deals, both with Singapore and Australia. And I think the acquisition of Woolworths headquarters in November 2021 was at $463 million, a pretty sizable acquisition. And that really sort of drew upon engaging with our networks, both in Australia and Singapore, to lock in that transaction. So that for us is quite transformational, because the fund grew from about $1.8 billion to about $2.3 billion overnight. So that was really how it started. And really that was before sort of moving to the current role.
Right. And of course, after joining Ames for a little bit over a year, you were appointed as the new CEO.
Yeah.
Was that something that was already in your mind, or in discussion before you joined the company as part of the succession plan?
It wasn't. So I think from my perspective, I've always desired to add value to the business, which wherever I go, right? And so that's how I always think about new roles. Not thinking about the next role particularly, but more about the current role. I enjoyed the investment side of things. I enjoyed sort of executing on deals and growing businesses. But I think along the way, I did start to see, I was starting to get more involved with some of the operational methods in terms of, let's say, major capital expenditure items, some of the development projects that we were looking at. So I did start to feel that perhaps I was given some broader opportunities, but certainly no, it wasn't a discussion at the time. But the way I see it, I'm always ready for new challenges, right? I've never shied away from taking challenges.
Once you take on the new role, although you are still in the same company, did it shift your perception of all the things that you are seeing on the ground? And what was the first thing, I guess, you started implementing, started to change?
Sure. Look, certainly it was a big change. When the board offered that opportunity, I did take some time to think through. And obviously, I was honored that they considered me as the for that position. But the first thing they said to me was, Russell, you're not an investment guy anymore. You're not focused on just acquiring assets. You're the chief people officer. You're the chief risk officer. You've got to look after the broader team. You've got to look after the investors in a more deliberate manner. So that really sort of shifted, I would say, the mindset in terms of my role. And I have this saying that I've also evolved, came from one of my mentors, who explained to me, when you're sort of moving to a fairly senior position, you've got to balance yourself, your time. On the operational matters and spend time with the people and really engage with key commercial outcomes. You've got to look ahead. And so that really means working with, looking at new growth opportunities. What can we acquire this year or how do we undertake a new acquisition or new asset enhancements to grow DPU? But then you've got to think 3 or 5 years ahead. And so that also, entails engaging the board and sort of tapping on their expertise. As well as engaging the market in terms of unit holders and finances to explain the vision so that you do have the support to continue to grow the business.
Can you share a little bit about your own management philosophy as well, right? How do you think about managing your whole organization? Are you someone that is more attention to detail to the smallest level, or someone who tends to dedicate on a decentralized energy?
Sure. Look, I would say my leadership philosophy and style has evolved over the years and has changed. Really through combination of reading, observing, past leaders, bosses that I've had, looking at some of my prime mentors, some of their philosophies. So it has really evolved. I think for me, I would say I'm a fairly team-based collaborative leader. I do delegate. I would say I get into the detail when I need to be, but I try to give my staff and team really a lot of autonomy because people need to have some level of space to make decisions and to come up with proposals and to potentially also fail in some of those decisions, right? Because that's how you learn. And through that process of constant sort of growing, pushing yourself a little bit, making some errors here and there, that's how you grow. So that's really been my style, giving people the opportunity to come up with their own proposals and ideas. But it's also important to have a lot of people in the room to collectively consider different opinions, because decisions, it's not just one person. It involves many different viewpoints. And understanding the various data points, the backgrounds, the nuances of certain decisions. Most of the time, you won't get 100% of the data points. You might get, they always say 70, 80% should be good enough to move forward. And if it's not the right decision, you have to think about whether you've got to pivot halfway through or if not, you've got to really go back to the drawing board and rethink about your strategy for the next initiative. So that's really the style. I do try to also have a longer term approach. So most of the things that we do, I'm trying to think out over the next 2 or 3 years as well. What will be good for the business from a longer term perspective. So that has evolved. And obviously coming from an investment standpoint, we just focus on the next deal. it might take from 6 to 9 months to just focus on getting that deal done. And that was something I would say I've been relatively now strong at. And now sort of taking a step back, not rushing to every deal and really thinking, does this add to the portfolio? Does it give us longevity? Does it have future redevelopment potential? If the tenant moves out, was there going to be any hiccups from a portfolio standpoint if the asset's too large and the tenant sucks, I think the tenant defaults, is that going to have a big impact on the UPU? So I'm looking more of the big picture rather than just do very team work.
Of course, you fall into this new role, but at the same time, you're also trying to manage one of the worst crises that we face, which is COVID-19. Yeah. And the real estate industry would be, one of the worst hit sector apart from airlines as well. So tell me a little bit more, what's your thought process during your time? What's happening to your REIT and how do you guys, regroup?
Look, I would say when I moved into the role, fortunate that we had a very strong team. So most of our teams are very strong industry professionals that understand the market. And they're very proactive. So when I moved into the role, sat with the team to understand exactly how things were being run. But I think that the biggest issue at the time was how do we sort of manage staff communication, people working from home, being coordinated, how do we support our tenants, particularly as many of them were considered to be essential services. So those in the logistics industry, healthcare, life sciences, they continue to operate. So how can we continue to support them through that process? And so a lot of it was really through constant communication, either through Zoom. Fortunately, that really sort of opened up that dialogue much more effectively. Setting up protocols so that the staff knew exactly what they needed to do. And also constant tenant engagement as well during that process. Some tenants, for example, may not be able to pay rent. And so you have to really sort of work with them because, again, we look at our tenants as really customers and long-term partners. And so they were going through a tough time. And so really just managing that cash flow, that was very much a key attribute during that process. But we managed to come through relatively unscathed. Most of our tenants not only continued to perform, some were actually thriving during that process. So again, we're fortunate to be, I guess, in the right industry, unlike some of the other sectors where there's a bit more, lesser traffic, lesser occupation. So I would say that's been key for us. And that's really also shown in our financial performance because if I look at my last two financial years, our occupancy was close to about 98% over the last 2 years or so. Revenue is up both years by about 16% to 18%. And DPU was also up about 5.7% or 5.1%. So that was really a combination of really managing that tenant relationship well, making sure that we are serving our customers, and also complementing the ongoing asset management with acquisitions, because we did complete an acquisition of 7 Bullet, one of the land up logistics facility, leased to KWE, a major Japanese 3PL. And that was done in October 20, just right in the midst of COVID. And we also acquired the Woolworths headquarters in November 2021. So a year later. So that really sort of augmented the performance. I think we were quite fortunate.
I guess one trend that came out from COVID, of course, is remote work.
Yes.
And although it wouldn't be affecting most of your REITs property, given that it's industrial in nature, but you do have some business tasks.
Yes.
And how do you see this trend of remote work, even after COVID?
Sure. So look, I think COVID, besides work from home, there are many different new trends that came out of it. The work from home, I don't think will affect offices over the long term. People still need office space. Perhaps the amount of office space needed might be lesser. But I don't think that's going to remove the need for office spaces because that's a place where people come in to collaborate and to work. And there's a lot of good ideas come up for. For us in particular, we do have two pretty large business parks in Australia. But they are leased for 8 to 10 years. So Optus has got another 10 years remaining. Woolworths has another 8 years remaining. So we made it a point when we acquired Woolworths, we spent a lot of time looking at the credit of that particular tenant, making sure that they're very strong and a top tenant in this company. And I think importantly for these assets, they sit on very large land sites. So there is a longer term potential for both these properties to have redevelopment For Woolworths in particular, we can increase the building area from 44,000 square meters to 180,000 square meters, so to offer 500 square feet of wool space that could be developed in the future. So that's how we evaluated that asset from an investment standpoint and also longer-term growth potential. We do have one small business park in our portfolio, one international business park. Now, this property, the occupancy is a bit lower, about 60%. But it's been at this level for quite a number of years, not so much from COVID, maybe an indirect impact from COVID, but really there was a impact in the oil and gas industry, oil and gas bushmilling. And so that sucked up a lot of the underlying demand for that particular park. So we see the new infrastructure that's being built, that there's a new MRT that's being constructed just down the road, and that will be open in a few years, as well as the relocation of the Megaport to Tuas. Mm. That's going to really sort of shift the actual office demand for this particular location, because what we see is a lot of our existing tenants in this building have quite a number of operations out west towards Tuas and Geelong Prince.
Right.
But this is an asset that's probably less than about 2% of our portfolio. Mm. I know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. From what you describe, it seems that you feel that the threat of remote work and work from home is something that can be mitigated. And does that mean that in future, if there's a good deal on other business stuff, you're still open to it?
I think it's a deal by deal basis. If the same property that we sold, the Woolworths headquarters, had a 2 or 3 year work, we probably wouldn't be pursuing it, because in a time like this where markets are uncertain, you do want income stability. So I wouldn't say we would look at buying business parks, particularly unless there's the investment merits are there. We've got good asset specs. We've got a good tenant credit. We've got a stable or growing rental income. And I think for us in particular, for these assets, you've got a land bank that is being supported by improving infrastructure.
Mm.
And so just to give you an example as well with the office center, our other business park, it's in Macquarie Park. So there are a lot of high rises that have been constructed around this particular property. Office is a collection of six buildings with four levels, but everywhere around us, you have 15 story buildings being constructed. In fact, at our doorstep, there is a big mixed-use project, 2,000 dwellings. There's a retail shop front there. There are amenities. So the underlying land value of this site is growing over time. And Woolworths is also very much similar sort of case, where you've got data centers around you. You've got quite a number of businesses in the pharma space, healthcare space, mobile as well. So there is that critical mass and ecosystem for both business parks.
Okay. I'm asking that mainly because, we see other industrial REIT in Singapore, for example, Mapletree Industrial Trust, over the past few years, really moving, I guess, pivoting and moving very aggressively into other types of property asset like data centers,
sure.
Right? So I'm just wondering your view on that. Is it something that you would be open to pursue, or you prefer to keep your current strategy? How do you position AIMS for the next 3 to 5 years?
Sure. Well, I think data center is certainly an area where it is benefiting from the whole world moving towards AI, digital. There's a lot of new data that needs to be processed and stored. So certainly it's an area that we are keeping a lookout on. We do have an asset that is also a data center. In fact, we've converted that property in Taising, and it was announced in December. We essentially now agree with the data center operator to take a master lease for that building. So certainly an area that we are looking and monitoring. However, really to find sites available, it's not easy. And I think particularly in Singapore, there is a moratorium, which makes it difficult to develop that particular strategy. But look, as part of our overall portfolio, that is really one subset. So when we look at our portfolio in terms of growth, we say we've got a pretty strong foundation of business park assets, which make up about a third, business parks and high tech. So they're more dealing with your high value added services and industries, with high office content, with some R&D. So for our particular example, we've got about a third of our portfolio, 7 to 10 year leases that provide income stability. We've got 40% in logistics and warehouse, which again we like because most of these contracts with 3PLs are typically shorter lease terms. So you have the ability to mark to market and capitalize on current sort of favorable market conditions. Over the last year, we actually achieved an 18.5% rent reversion. I think one of the highest amongst our LPs. In fact, perhaps across the industry. And so we like that mix. The balance 20% is in the general industrial, which for us comprises advanced manufacturing, means advisors who make precision robots and parts, as well as food-related industries as well. And so I would say we have a fairly balanced mix. We would like to obviously grow both the logistics and also the advanced manufacturing type space that caters towards life science and healthcare and also data centers. And why is that important? Because you do have companies that operate in fairly defensive industries that are considered to be essential. And so that really provides the resilience to the income performance for the portfolio. Around 80% of our portfolio operate in these essential defensive industries.
In business, I always feel that the key point, the key job of management is to solve problems and tackle challenges. And there's never a short fall of problems for you to solve. And right after COVID now, I guess one of the biggest challenges facing a lot of REITs is the rising interest rate as well.
Yeah,
Raymond. And just want to hear from you, what are your thoughts on that? And how do you plan to mitigate this risk? Or do you feel that, this additional cost could quite be easily be transferred to rising rental rates in the future?
Well, very, very good question, because, real estate is obviously affected by credit and interest rates. Now, what's actually causing a rise in interest rates is really the rise in inflation. I think there's a lot of I guess free money that was actually printed during COVID times, which is now having that unintended consequences of rising inflation. And so rising inflation, I guess firstly, it does increase operating costs, term contracts, also increases construction pricing. So when we're pursuing more redevelopments, it does make it much more difficult. And so to manage that process, obviously there is that rise of interest rates to hopefully taper down inflation and manage operating costs. For us as a business, we try to sort of tackle it through different layers. The first one is ensuring that most of our leases, particularly for our master tenants, we have a triple net arrangement. So most of these operating costs are paid and managed for by master tenants. So we have about 44% of our leases and on a master tenant arrangement. The balance 55%, you're right, we do also have rental escalations to help offset some of the rising costs. But we also, at the start of this year, implemented a service charge review that was essentially in line with market. So we did follow where the market was going, probably a couple months later. Mm. But essentially that has helped cushion some of the operating cost increases. Things like energy costs is also very topical, and that's also being restructured so that most of the cost is essentially sort of managed and flowed through to the underlying tenants. But fortunately, that market we've seen has started to stabilize as well. Now, on interest rates, again, it's certainly an area where it affects DPU. We did increase our hedge ratio, I would say, just before the rate hike started to take place. So we were close to about 60, 65%. We did increase that hedge ratio to about 19%, probably ahead of the hikes. And I remember speaking to my CFO saying, we're either going to look good or we're going to look like we have maybe started too early on our hedging program. So again, that's been fortunate because we did start to hear there was pressure within the system to potentially raise rates to combat inflation. So we took advantage of that sort of noise that we were hearing to really sort of manage our hedging strategy ahead of the curve. And the other thing, again, probably was more fortunate than not, we spent a bit of time pushing through our refinancing ahead of the maturities. So as a result, we only had a small refinancing tranche that was due last financial year, about 13 million or so. And so we really didn't have any enough refinancing pressure over the last 12, 18 months. And again, fortunately, there's no refinancing due this financial year as well. But we are planning ahead because I think ultimately that the markets are uncertain. We want to make sure that you have all your financing lines in place. You also want to make sure that you have sufficient cash and undrawn lines from the banks to utilize in case there's a need of a cushion for working capital purposes. And so COVID has obviously taught us that we do need to prepare and think well ahead of time. That's fairly key, particularly managing a REIT.
And then this leads to, I guess, there's a recent announcement from you guys that you're going to be raising a preferential offer. And can you share a little bit more about that deal? What's it about and why now?
Sure. We on the 1st of May, we announced a $100 million equity fundraising exercise. So a combination of that would be through a placement. And I think 30 million of that would be through a pref offering. So really the fundraising was really sort of done now to solve two problems. One is to ensure that there was funding certainty. We had two asset enhancement projects that are currently in the works. They'll make up close to about 30 million. And so these projects are essentially refurbishing and upgrading assets that we own to ensure that they are improved to a higher and modern specs to allow us to really find and attract really good quality corporates, as well as at higher rents. So that was that first purpose. The second purpose was really to reduce our gearing and really be on a lookout for opportunities as and when they come. What we've seen in the past is the best opportunities will come when there's potentially a downturn, when people least expect it. And usually the best opportunities come, the credit and capital markets are not available. So from our perspective, having the gearing at its current levels, about 32%, will allow us to really be patient and look for opportunities that may come, whether it's 3, 6, 12 months from today. But we have enough projects already on hand. So the current two projects will capitalize about 30 million of that 100 million. And we're also exploring another development that we have where there's an existing master tenant that's expiring next year. And that will allow us to potentially redevelop that property into a much more modern facility and increase that plot ratio quite substantially as well.
Okay. So a lot of plans on the pipeline?
Look, we're always looking at both organic growth and opportunistically at a new acquisition as well.
Right. Okay. Now I really want to maybe touch back a little bit on your personal, on a personal level, right? And I've been interviewing a lot of entrepreneur and also business leaders from across the region here. Some managing, of course, like yourself, listed entities, but some also just managing startups as well. And what I found across, all of them is they are generally very optimistic in nature and positive. They're not bogged down and have a rather bright outlook in life. And so I just want to understand, from your view, is this something that has always been innate in you, that you are a positive person, or is it something that you feel that anyone can cultivate this attitude to become successful in life?
Look, I think for some people it's innate. They just grew up, they've got lots of energy. I think for me, it was really sort of cultivated from young, I would say probably through sports, going through adversity, winning and losing some, working with teammates and having this camaraderie as well. So I would say that is usually something that has helped me as I move through. I would also say that I've been through quite a number of challenges throughout my career. Some people ask, well, you've come to a pretty senior level. Has it had a smooth ride? It's not. It's always a lot of ups and downs. I've seen it through multiple times in my career where you're on a high and there could be a down. And then when it's a down, it's a high. So we always say when the wind is flowing your way, don't be too happy. When the sales are down and things are not moving, don't be too sad because, life goes through these waves of cycles, right? Just like the property market. And so optimism and confidence for me has, really has been built over the years. And really, I think that comes also, by really achieving something that has been tough, that's been difficult, that's been high stakes, high value. Because when you get something that is, when you achieve something difficult that is hard, that's what builds the confidence, right? And so there are many examples where I've achieved something, but there were obstacles along the way where I could have failed. And so knowing that that failure could have happened, but you've achieved it, and you basically had to navigate and pivot along the way, I think that's what helps build confidence. And that also happens through reflection, because you've got to think through what happened, right? And then so when you actually achieve an outcome, it's not just by luck, right? It's not just by just doing this. And actually, you have to navigate and pivot always in terms of particular business ventures as well. Mm.
I used the term successful just now. And in my books, I definitely view you as a very successful person. But the definition of success has changed, I guess, over this period of time. And, in the past, say I'm an 80s kid, when people talk about success, it's just mean one thing, right? Just get rich. But now it's more nuances. And I just want to hear from you personally, what's your take on the success? What does it mean to you?
Okay. I'll probably answer it in probably two ways. The first one is, I've never, pursued my career in terms of trying to be successful in that sense. I've made it a point that wherever I move into, and I said to my bosses and my peers, put me where you think I'm most useful, is probably the first one. The second one is, wherever I go, I've got to focus on what value adds and focus on what matters for the company or for the team, for the boss, for my colleagues. So when I always focus on that to achieve an outcome, so I'm always a very an outcome-driven person. I would say that's led to the success, right? The after event. So I haven't strived for success as a target, but more, I've always strived to just be relevant in the role that I've been appointed to. So that's probably how I see success in that sense. I guess as you age and you've got family and you've got other things that are going on in your life, you've got to balance. And there's always what I say, the four quadrants, where you're trying to balance your career, your work, your family life, your friendships, and your health. Now, it's difficult to balance all four at any one time. So it's not about having a balance. It's more about just when you're in one category, you've got to be present. You've got to be focused, because I've been in numerous examples where you're with family, but you're thinking about work, right? Or you're with work, but you're thinking about family. So success is, I would say, managing the four quadrants so that you never let one quadrant fall away, right? You need all four, I would say, to have a successful life, because at the end of your career, the work's not going to be there. It's going to be your friend, it's going to be your family, your friends, and your health. So you do have to balance the four, but it's not an even balance at all times. But when you're with one quadrant, focus the effort and will be present in that quadrant at that time. That to me is probably success.
Right. Yeah. That's beautifully put. And it also, ties to something that I've been wondering as well, right? Because of this, more diverse definition of success for everyone right now, when you think about attracting talent to work for you, and especially in the REIT sector in Singapore, it's quite competitive with quite a number of REITs here in Singapore as well. But just a respect moment, right? Yeah. And how do you think of conveying that message and attract talents to work for you, and cultivating and helping them realize their success within your organization?
Sure. Look, I'll probably answer that in two ways. One, you're right, there are many REITs in the market. We're not small, we're not big. We're probably somewhere halfway. But I would say for anyone looking to or interested in pursuing a career, I would say look for an organization that maybe aligns more closely with your values. It's probably one thing, right? For us, it's about empowering our staff, giving them autonomy to grow and to learn. But we're also looking for staff who are motivated to do something, to build. We're not a big company. We don't have a huge support staff. A difference, right? I've worked in both boutique companies, a team of five, I've worked in large corporates where you've got over 20,000 staff. It's very different, right? And so with the larger the company you work at, there's a lot more bureaucracy, there's a lot more systems and process, and you're just one person in that system. For a smaller company, everything that you do is very visible, right? And so when you can contribute and add value to their business, it's a lot more rewarding as well. But you don't have all the systems and resources and support and times to help you do what you need to do. So we're probably somewhere halfway. So we're looking for someone who is, you know, really people who are young and dynamic, who want to make a difference, but also have, you know, very similar values to what we live and breathe within this company. The second one I would say is, you know, when you look across the REIT market, there are many different sectors. Industrial REITs at the moment, I would say, are in a pretty favorable position because of the supply, demand, and balance that we're currently seeing in the market. And also what we're seeing is there's this, you know, new reconfiguration of supply chains, manufacturing hubs. Singapore is a beneficiary. And so the way I see the market, I think the market has, the right infrastructure in place, the right government support in place. And so I always say we're in the right place at the right time. And again, always looking for bright people to join us.
Right, great. And one final question that I always ask my guests is that, you know, if you have a redo in life, if you go back to a key inflection point of your life, what advice would you give your previous self, you know, on embarking on this journey?
I would say be adventurous. I would almost say yes to when you're younger, say yes to everything, right? Be it new job, new role, new country, because that will give you a lot more perspective. You know, particularly as you get older, your families, you know, both start to be a bit more focused. But for me personally, I have been quite focused. I wouldn't change my journey, but I would say have a more of an open mindset, reach out to more people, engage more people, seek different advice very early on. A lot of my learnings, I think early on, were more, try, do, learn, make errors, learn again. If you can find someone that has been through a similar journey as well, you know, that really shortcuts a lot of that processes. So that's probably what I would do. Be open-minded, try it, you know, say yes to everything, and really try to, you know, find advice from mentors or people that you look up to very early on to shortcut your learnings.
And I guess one last question before you go. I might not know this, but are you a father yourself right now?
Yes, I am.
Right. And yeah. And one question, I guess this is more for my personal learning, mainly because I have a few young kids as well. And I just want to understand, you know, on parenting, right now, what are some of the key things that you're trying to instill in your kids and maybe prepare them for the world ahead, especially when you look at, we can't be able to tell how their world going to be look like in the future, especially with the development of artificial intelligence at such rapid pace, and where is the correct path for them? Now, we can't really predict that. But what are some of the key qualities or, I guess, characteristics that you want to instill in them for their life? And why do you feel that those are important?
Very topical, because I've got two boys. One is 14, one is 10. And so I do speak to particularly my oldest son, who is a teenager, has his own views about principles and values. So my principles when I was young was about working hard, never be complacent, always strive to improve. I think for my son now, it's really about trying to teach him to think, because, you know, I think a lot of what they go through is just, studying and learning, particularly in the local system, in the Asian system, the focus is on academics. Mm. But actually, life is much more about academics, right? When you move into the real world, interrelationships, communication, you know, all these things are very important. But also importantly, how do you think? How do you evaluate options? So I do try to get him to think through problems himself and see how we'll solve it together. I do try to guide him in terms of not just taking things at face value, to question, to think. And particularly, you're right, with artificial intelligence, you know, that could potentially replace jobs. And so the only way to combat that is to think ahead and not just follow, similar type of wordings. We've got to think more broadly than that. So I would say that's probably something I would try to teach them. Ultimately, for them to be independent, self-sufficient, but also to have more of a holistic view of life, and not just focus on the academics, but it's important to have sports, it's important to build friendships, and to connect socially with people, which is very difficult because most kids today are always on their iPhones, connecting virtually, right? But I think it is a new generation, so it's very difficult to impose what I see as sort of core principles, but hopefully, if I say it enough times, he would get it one day, just like my father has said to me, the same set of principles to myself.
Right. Thank you so much, Russ. I really enjoyed our talk and I learned so much from you today. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Stanley.
I'm Stanley and you have been listening to The Asian Mavericks, produced by Value Invest Asia. If you like this show, please give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, if you know of the perfect candidate for us to interview for our next episode, you can always reach out to us through our social media. Thank you. Until we meet again, stay safe.